ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Lindsay Clancy heard a voice. Not a feeling, not a dark thought she couldn't shake. A voice, loud, male, repetitious. According to her civil lawsuit, it said, "This is your last chance. Kill the children so you can kill yourself." And then it said it again and again. And according to her account, she lost all control. That is not postpartum depression. That is not the baby blues. That is not a woman who was sad or overwhelmed or struggling to bond with a newborn. That's a woman whose brain manufactured a sound, a voice that did not exist in the physical world, and presented it to her as indistinguishable from reality. She could not tell the difference between that voice and her husband talking to her from the next room. That is postpartum psychosis. And the distance between what that term actually means and what most people think it means is the distance between everything that matters in this case. We're going to go through this today. I welcome your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube so we can continue discussing this there. Lindsay Clancy's murder trial begins with jury selection. That's going on right now as we record this in Plymouth Superior Court. She is charged with 3 counts of murder in the deaths of her children, Cora, 5 years old, Dawson, 3, Callan, 8 months. She has not denied what happened. Her defense is not that she didn't do it. Her defense is that she was not in contact with reality when she did it. And the argument her legal team is making comes down to a medical condition that affects 1 in 2 women out of every 1,000 births, a condition so rare that most OBGYNs will go their entire career without seeing a case, a condition that the medical system has almost no standardized screening for, a condition where the person experiencing it often has no idea it's happening. Here's why that matters to you, because when you have an opinion about Lindsay Clancy's guilt or not, because somebody you know, your sister, your daughter, your friend, your coworker will have a baby, and if it happens to her, and you don't know what it looks like, you'll miss it. Her doctor might miss it too. Lindsay Clancy's doctors apparently did too, and I put that in air quotes. So let me explain this in a way that doesn't require a medical degree, because the conversation around this case has collapsed 3 completely different diagnoses into one word, postpartum. And the confusion is doing real damage. Let's start with the baby blues. That's the most common postpartum experience. Up to 85% of new mothers go through some version of it. Mood swings, crying easily, feeling overwhelmed. It usually resolves on its own within 2 weeks. It is normal. It does not involve any disconnect from reality. This is not that. then there actually is kind of the next step of postpartum depression. That is a clinical diagnosis. About 1 in 7 women experience it. Persistent sadness, hopelessness, fatigue, difficulty bonding with the baby. It can be debilitating. It's also treatable with therapy, medication, and support, and it does not involve hallucinations. A woman with postpartum depression knows where she is. She knows who her baby is. She knows what's real. She is suffering, but she's operating inside the same reality as everyone else. Postpartum psychosis is something else entirely. It is not a more severe form of postpartum depression. It's like in its own other arena. So to say, well, it's just a stronger version of it, really completely discounts what it is. It's like saying an orange, you know, the food you eat is the same as a Nike, the shoe you use. No, they're really not at all remotely the same things. It's not the next step on the spectrum. It's a separate psychiatric emergency with a different set of symptoms and a fundamentally different relationship to reality. And the single most important thing I can tell you about it is this. The person experiencing it usually does not know it is happening. Think about that. You have a complete break from reality, hallucinations, delusions, paranoia, command voices telling you to do things, and not know that anything is wrong because the hallucinations feel real. They sound real. They look real. Your brain is not giving you a warning label. Your brain is telling you that the voice you hear is as legitimate as traffic noise or your baby crying. There's no internal signal that says that's a hallucination. The whole point of a hallucination is that your brain treats it as genuine sensory input. Cleveland Clinic describes it as a condition where a person cannot tell the difference between a hallucination and something that is truly happening. The delusions, false beliefs held with absolute conviction are so strong that no amount of evidence will change them. A woman with postpartum psychosis might believe her baby is possessed. She might believe someone is trying to poison her child through her breast milk. She might believe God has given her a command, and she holds those beliefs with the same certainty that you hold the belief that you're watching me do this right now or listening to me tell you this right now. She's not choosing to believe them. Her brain has made them facts. The symptoms can include auditory hallucinations, hearing voices, hearing commands, hearing conversations that are not happening. Visual hallucinations, seeing people who are not there. The Massachusetts General Women's Center for Women's Mental Health describes women who experience command auditory hallucinations that instruct them to harm themselves or their baby. Some women experience mania, racing thoughts, surging energy, grandiosity, going days without sleep while feeling fine. Some experiences rapid mood swings so severe that they can appear euphoric one moment and catatonic the next. And here's a detail that should terrify every person listening who has a new mother in their life. The symptoms ebb and flow. A woman in active psychosis can appear completely normal to her family. She can get dressed, she can feed the baby, she can make conversation, she can perform motherhood while her brain is disassembling reality behind her eyes. Experts describe this as one of the most dangerous features of the illness. The person can function in some aspects of daily life while simultaneously experiencing a total break from reality. She can, as one clinician put it, put on a good face. Lindsay Clancy put on a good face. She was a labor and delivery nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital. She spent her career helping mothers through the most vulnerable moments of their lives. She worked inside the medical system that was supposed to catch this. And when postpartum psychosis happened to her, to a trained healthcare professional who knew more about maternal health than most of the people treating her, she could not identify it herself. She asked for help time and time again. And the system failed her time and time again. That should land on every person who has ever said, she should have known something was wrong. She did know something was wrong. She told everyone who would listen that something was wrong. She went to appointments. She called crisis line. She checked herself into McLean Hospital, one of the most prestigious psychiatric facilities in the country. On January 1st, 2023, because she was having thoughts. Can't say that word on the YouTube. She was discharged 4 days later. Her providers kept prescribing medication and scheduling 17-minute video appointments. She did everything the system tells a struggling mother to do. The system did not do what it was supposed to do in return. Between September of 2022 and January 23, Lindsay Clancy was prescribed at least 9 different psychiatric medications: Zoloft, Trazodone, Prozac, Ambien, Remeron, Klonopin, Seroquel, Valium, Lamitol. And according to both the civil lawsuit filed by her husband, Patrick, and the civil lawsuit she filed herself, her providers added and accelerated these medications in an ad hoc manner. They did not coordinate care. They did not run the diagnostic tests that would have told them why she was having adverse reactions to medications that should have helped her. Because you can't mix and match the shit like Tic Tacs and Skittles. Her husband told a friend that Lindsay seemed over-medicated. He described her as acting like a zombie. He said she had the worst side effects possible and had become dependent on benzodiazepines. When she sought help from Women and Infants Hospital in Rhode Island, staff there determined her issues were likely the result of over-medication and misdiagnosis. They reached out to her nurse practitioner to discuss her care, and according to the lawsuit, the nurse practitioner never responded. A forensic psychiatrist who evaluated Lindsay from the defense diagnosed her with bipolar disorder 1, severe, with psychosis and anxious distress with postpartum onset. That diagnosis rewrites the entire medical narrative, because antidepressants, the medications her providers kept prescribing and increasing, are documented in medical literature as capable of triggering manic and psychotic episodes in people with undiagnosed bipolar disorder. Her providers never tested for bipolar. They kept treating anxiety and depression. According to the defense's expert, they may have been chemically accelerating the condition that ultimately destroyed her family. And that brings me back to the distinction that matters more than anything else in this case. Lindsay told her providers she was having intrusive thoughts. Her civil lawsuit alleges those were actively auditory hallucinations. She was hearing voices, but she did not have the language for what was happening to her. She used the closest term she knew. She called them thoughts. Her providers took that label that she gave them and treated it as anxiety. Nobody asked the follow-up questions. Nobody said, when you say intrusive thoughts, do you mean a thought that enters your mind, or do you mean a voice that you hear? Because those are two completely different diagnoses. An intrusive thought is a symptom of anxiety or OCD. An auditory hallucination is a symptom of psychosis, one that gets treated with therapy and antidepressants. The other is a psychiatric emergency that requires immediate hospitalization, antipsychotics, and round-the-clock monitoring. The distance between those two things is the distance between a treatable condition and a catastrophe. And in Lindsay Clancy's case, that question was never asked. There is a structural reason for that failure. The screening tools used at most OBGYN and pediatric offices across the country are designed to catch postpartum depression. They ask about sadness, hopelessness, difficulty bonding, crying. They do not screen for psychosis. There is no standardized screening for postpartum psychosis in routine postnatal care anywhere in the United States. The rarest and most dangerous postpartum condition is the one the system is least equipped to detect. The prosecution's position in this case is that Lindsay Clancy planned and executed these killings in a clear state of mind, that framing, and then just as a shitty human being. That framing lands on every mother in America sitting in a waiting room trying to decide whether to tell her doctor that something feels wrong. Experts have said publicly that the rhetoric around this case is dangerous. An OBGYN nurse and prenatal mental health advocate told the Boston Globe that when prosecutors paint Lindsay as a monster who carried out premeditated murder, they erase the medical reality. The message it sends to every struggling parent is simple and devastating. Nothing can help you. Massachusetts General Hospital Center for Women's Mental Health published a response specifically because the public conversation was blurring the lines between postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis, and they were worried the confusion would stop women from seeking care. Psychosis and planning can coexist. That is not a defense argument. That's a published psychiatric finding in literature. A study of homicides committed by individuals with schizophrenia found that roughly 43% showed clear elements of premeditation, and many were still found not criminally responsible because the planning occurred within a psychotic framework. A person can be methodical inside a delusion. The planning is real. The reality within which the planning occurs is not. Andrea Yates drowned her 5 children in 2001. Her actions were purposeful and sequential. She waited for her husband to leave. She filled a bathtub. She brought each child to the water one at a time. She was ultimately found not guilty by reason of insanity because she was operating inside a psychotic belief that she was saving her children from Satan. I'm not telling you what to think about Lindsay Clancy's criminal responsibility. A jury of 18 people is going to spend the next 6 to 8 weeks hearing evidence. And so are you if you want to take this in on our podcast feed, wherever you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, press subscribe, search Hidden Killers. You'll get all of the trial audio every day. I'm telling you what postpartum psychosis is, because if you walked into that case thinking postpartum means sad or overwhelmed or struggling, you're missing the thing that matters most. 3 children are gone. Cora, Dawson, Callan. Their father came home with takeout and found them. Patrick Clancy will testify at the trial for his wife's defense. He filed a wrongful death lawsuit against her medical providers. He asked the public to forgive Lindsay. He said the real Lindsay was generous, loving, and caring towards everyone. He said the fibers of her soul are loving. He said all he wishes for her now is that she can somehow find peace. This is not a man who is confused about what happened to his children. This is a man who watched from the inside as his wife disappeared into something neither of them had the tools to understand. Well, the people who were supposed to have those tools kept scheduling 17-minute appointments. Next, our time is up here. Take this. Make sure you have a granola bar with it. The next time a mother, you know, tells you something feels wrong, that something feels off, that she's having thoughts she can't explain after she had a baby, the question is not, are you sad? The question is, what are you hearing? Understanding this condition is the battle. Punishing someone for experiencing it and not getting the treatment that she needed when she was begging for it, when she was seeking it out over and over and over and over again, is not justice for those 3 children. It's not justice for anybody. If there's anything this case should do, it should educate us and it should teach us about what this condition is. Understand it's very real, and it can happen to anyone. And women should not feel scared to share what they're experiencing and what they're seeing and what they're hearing, if any at all, with the people they trust and care. Because that's the bridge between something very wrong and getting help. But the more it's stigmatized, the more it's not understood, the more it's like, oh, turn that frown upside down, the more we'll see cases like this. The more people won't understand it. And the more Lindsay Clancy's we'll be talking about. So go into this case with a clear understanding of what this is all about before you make your judgments. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Like I said, we're going to be bringing you the audio of the trial throughout the course of the trial on our podcast channels, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, wherever you get podcasts. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and be sure to press subscribe and you'll be getting the trial audio every day along with all of our commentary and discussions on this and the many cases we cover for you right here. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Yeah, let's go over to another case that is rearing its head this week, finally. Lindsay Clancy, a January night in Duxbury, Massachusetts, Patrick Clancy left home to go pick up takeout and came back to the end of his entire world. His wife, Lindsay, was on the ground beneath a second-story window, and Cora, Dawson, and a baby, Callan, were in the basement. 3.5 years later, she's finally facing a jury. 18 of them, more than they seated for Karen Reed, on 3 counts of first-degree murder. Her lawyers say 13 prescriptions broke her brain, which they did, and prosecutors say she planned it. Yeah, just on her own, never mind the 13, you know, antipsychotics going in and out of her system every other day. And every message you've seen lands on the same impossible question. Can a mother be sick and guilty at the same time? Your thoughts as we break this down in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, here to help us discuss. Can she be guilty and sick at the same time, Robin?
That's a great question. This is the most horrendous case to me because there's three babies that are dead because of her, and that needs to be accounted for, which she owns. But because, like you said, all these medications, misprescribed, whatever the reason, broke her brain. And she had a psychotic, well, what is being claimed by defense, a psychotic episode, is a one-off, because she does not have a behavior arc or pattern of having done these horrendous things in the past. In the sense of, you know, although she said it, she made threats, she sought help. So I don't know how the I'm glad I'm not on that jury.
I want to throw, this is, for whatever reason, in 2026, we still can't wrap our minds in this country around the fact that our minds involve health as well. It's not just our other organs that can get unhealthy. Our brains can get very unhealthy. And that happens to be the originating source for about 90-some% of the problems in our country. Mm-hmm. Unhealthy brains, yet so many places are like, we're not even going to consider your mental health. It's either you're bad or you're good. Your brain has nothing to do with it. Let's just go down a route here, a thought experiment, if you will. Let's say there was something else wrong with Lindsay Clancy, or anybody for that matter, and the doctors prescribed 13 different medications, on and off, on and off, on and off, different dosage, up it, lower, take it off, don't do this one. But you're talking to different doctors. Nobody's communicating about this between them, the doctors, because that's how the system's set up to fail or work. It is what it is. That's how the system works, quote unquote. Doesn't mean it's effective, but that's how it functions, I should say. So let's say you do this and you get on off all these medications, and eventually it totally fucks up your heart in some way, shape, or form. It's just, it's not beating right. It's irregular. It's going off the charts, and it's a very unhealthy state. But you're in that state because you raised your hand and went to doctors and said, there's something wrong with my heart. I need help for this. And they bounce you around to all this. And at the end of the day, you have a heart attack and you're driving your car and it goes off a cliff with your kids in it, and you're in it too. Is that because of you? Or is that because of the 13 different medications that totally fucked up your body and didn't help anything, even though you were trying to get help and ended up killing everyone because one hand couldn't communicate with the other within the medical community? Take the brain out of it. If it was a different organ that killed everybody, would we be having the same conversation?
Yeah, it's a great thought experiment, because the question I ask is, I'm very curious about it, it'll hopefully come out in trial, is, so they're bouncing around medications, and as a psychiatrist, they're trying to figure out what's broken in the brain. They're trying to medicate the brain. And And that can be very, very difficult, as we've seen in all these scenarios. I've known people, you've known people, and going on these micro milligrams sometimes of the chemicals needed to bring that brain back into healthy balance is very difficult. I'm curious about what advice they told her, what she could and couldn't do after they said her brain was or wasn't fixed. Because I think there, to me, the culpability is going to lie in the fact of, did they say she shouldn't have contact with her kids because of them being imbalanced? Or did they say, no, you're good to go to have contact with everyone? I think that'd be I'm interested in that question as well, because, like, to your point, you know, if, you know, going back to your thought experiment, if the doctor said, no, you're good to go, but then you have a heart attack and kill everyone in your car, what culpability does the doctor have saying you're good to go and you still wind up having a heart attack? These are tough questions.
Well, and I mean, there's a lot of issues in this story where one could go, well, we could have prevented it this way. Yeah, but we didn't. And we have no protocol to do so. And people aren't necessarily thinking automatically worst case scenario when you're dealing with something like this. We talked the other day, should Patrick have gone out to get takeout when he knew that his wife had said that she felt these feelings before about her harming the children? Probably not. But it might have been a good day. And he might have just made a really bad judgment call. And again, when you're in that scenario, when you have a partner that, you know, previous to this had never, you know, made some, you know, comments of that nature, and this is all new territory for yourself as well. You don't know. I mean, you take it seriously, but unfortunately, as humans, until we really see the end all consequences, we don't quite sometimes grasp how serious these situations are. So, you know, should he have stayed home? Maybe, you know, I mean, should the system have taken the kids out of the house? I mean, maybe, I mean, maybe he should have moved them somewhere. But again, you get to like really somewhat unfeasible territory or territory that is just not going to be the common reaction of ordinary human beings to prevent something like this. I get stuck on the medications. I mean, this is someone, and that's what gets me about this damn case. It's not like she was sitting there and they were like trying to convince her to take them. She was raising her hand. I need help. I need something. And whether, you know, I don't know that necessarily the medical community was, you know, intentionally trying to hurt her, but they do when they don't communicate with one another and they don't know who's prescribing what and how it's being communicated, which way and that way. All the more lesson, honestly, for the rest of us of why you have to be your own advocate when you're talking to a doctor and don't rely on the system reading their charts correctly, because they don't. But I don't know that there really was a realistic or reasonable, foreseeable prevention method for any of this. More than they were already taking, more than she was already taking on her own behest.
Yeah, you really hit the key word. And everyone's comments, I completely agree. These are questions that need to be asked and addressed. But that one word, reasonable, from what we've seen being presented in the public forum anyway, they were not flippant about what was going on with her.
Not
they weren't
at all.
Dismissive of it. They were doing all they could. They addressed it. She had a level of transparency and no shame with the fact that she needed medication. So, again, one of the comments was she telling her doctors everything? Well, she appeared to be, because she is being very transparent. She's a medical professional herself. She's a nurse, labor and delivery nurse. I mean, this is what they do, you know, because you can only get better and you expect your patients to share everything so you can treat them effectively. So I saw a reasonable effort from what we saw on the outside, but that's what the trial is going to really dig down on, was everyone doing as much as they reasonably could. And was anyone being flippant about the medication? Were they flipping about the expectations of her mental health? I mean, we're just not seeing it on the outside, but that's what these jurors are going to have to wade through, because this is horrible. It's a horrible case.
It is. A new development over the weekend, according to the Boston Globe. This is the Globe's reporting, not ours. I was trying to find records on it. I did so much digging and then stopped, but I'm going to try and dig more this weekend. I'm assuming this is probably accurate, but again, Boston Globe reporting this. The straight from her lawyer that they're divorced. This is new. This is a new thing. I'm not surprised. Apparently, they're divorced. He's remarried. married and has moved to New York, according to the Boston Globe, which apparently got that reporting from her attorney. The narrative thus far in the public has been that, you know, they're still married. He's standing by her side. He's still standing by her side. That's not changed. But the fact that they are divorced, that does seem to be a new piece to the story or understanding of the current situation. How do you think that affects this case, if at all, when the jury looks at it going, oh my gosh, well, he got divorced and he remarried. Does it affect it at all, or does it not? It's fairly realistic to expect your wife is in a mental health facility for the rest of her life. You might end up getting divorced and remarried, not because you don't love her or care about her or want the best for her well-being, but because you'd like to also live the rest of your life as well.
I think it's going to depend on the reason behind it. It's like, what caused the divorce? If that's the case, I'm looking it up right now,
probably this.
So right now I'm seeing they're not divorced. So let's just go down this conjecture. We've seen this before. You know, we have Asa Ellerup. She divorced Rex, but she's standing by his side regardless. So that was a financial aspect of it. We have, what's the phrase? Ruby Frankie's husband refused to divorce her, yet he probably should have. I think they're divorced now, though.
Yeah.
It really comes down to what's the intent. And it kind of struck me. The first thing that popped in my mind was the Delphi case. And here's why, is because he was always focused on her well-being. You know, Richard Allen's focused on his wife's well-being. And so I'd be curious about what spurred on, if they are divorced, if they are separated. Was it her saying, you need to get away from me, you need to move on, you need to protect yourself? Or was it him saying, I need to distance myself from your nutterness? So I think understanding that is what we need to have, if that is indeed true, that they are divorced or separated. But I'm seeing...
Most places, the Globe is the only one that's been reporting that over the weekend. But I mean, it's a reliable newspaper. So
I'm not dismissing it. It's a thought experiment. But I wouldn't. Yeah. As of right now, they would have to explore for me what was the impetus for it. Was it because of the trial, financial? I mean, there's a lot of reasons.
I would guess. I mean, my conjecture. Just moving on with your life. I mean, you can otherwise you're basically taking care of the person in the mental health facility, you really can't do it. They have to do it. And I don't know. I mean, it's not a crazy thought. I mean, I could see, I don't know. I don't know.
I could see him getting divorced so that whatever penalties that she faces, it doesn't bleed onto him.
That's true. Yeah.
And so I could see it for that reason. But given, again, only from what we see in the public eye and how they stuck together and how they worked together on all this, it's hard to imagine emotionally them separating for an emotional disconnect, because I see them pretty tight.
The public is very shocked by this case. How could a mother think of this? How could a mother think of harming their own children? And I mean, it's really, it's not funny. It's bizarre to me. It shows a level of disconnect from reality that the general public has on this subject, because it's icky and people like to talk about it and it makes them feel uncomfortable. But it's such a reality. This is a comment that says, I had postpartum with my second and the intrusive thoughts scare me so much. I've never told a soul. This is exactly why moms stay quiet. It is exactly why moms stay quiet, because if you do tell a soul that you're having these intrusive thoughts, the world can come down on you. And you don't get judged because of the condition you're in. You get judged as a human being by so many people because they don't understand mental health. They don't want to understand mental health. They just want to virtue signal that they're smarter and better and stronger than you, because it didn't happen to me. So how could it happen to you? That's why women don't talk about this. And I think it's also why the public has no freaking clue about it, because it's such a scary thing for women to talk about. Because if you say you have those thoughts while going through postpartum, most of the public is stupid enough to go 20 years later, do you still think about killing your kids? No, it's because of the mental health situation they were in at that moment in time. But then again, you're trying to rely on competent people to have the conversation with, which we're rather short of these days. Do you think that's part of why we have such a problem with the public understanding this, because of the fear of talking about what our brains are capable of doing.
Yeah, it's a lack of context from experience that people have on such horrendous things. Also, I do, because we keep hitting a generational thing today on in multiple cases, it's also a generational thing too. You know, I'm a Gen Xer. I know you are, Tony. You know, when you come up from a generation of just grin, bear it, and shut up and suck it up, that's what generally happens. I lost a very close. My wife and I both lost a friend from high school, from postpartum. She self-eliminated in a very horrendous way because of it. Never in a million years would you ever suspect a very, very beautiful, successful young woman. And it's horrendous.
Yeah.
But the positive, you know, it's funny. We're hitting some really positive notes today with the current generation. Basically, they're colorblind. They're very accepting. And one thing also this current generation is, because my daughter is part of it, my son too, very much into, if you need therapy, she'll be the first one to throw you into it. And there's no shame with it. So this is a generation that, unlike our generation of the shame, the stigma, that doesn't nearly exist. I know it exists in pockets and it's still there, but I think it's being flushed out more and more because people are more open to the fact that, hey, I think everyone understands we're all broken. We're all working on something. There's no shame to be working on something, because the only people in life that you really shouldn't trust are the ones that say they got it all going on right.
One more of this. I saw a comment, justice for those three innocent children. What is justice for those three innocent children? Is it locking up and throwing away the key on the mom who had postpartum psychosis, who begged for help from many different providers, who couldn't get the right hand to understand what the left hand was doing, basically poisoned her brain left and right in all these medications, and then when her brain acted the way it would, when you get that big of a mix of antipsychotics and other things in there, that she acted out the way she did while she was begging for help? Is it justice to lock her away for the rest of her life in a prison where she can't be in a mental health facility, which is what she's asking for? She's not asking to go back out in the street and shit out more kids. She's asking to be locked away in a mental health facility because she knows there was something wrong with her and she's so damn traumatized by what happened, she's never going to be whole again. So what exactly is justice for those three kids in this case, the bumper sticker slogan that ignorant people like to throw out there?
I think justice is learning from having the medical facilities, medical professionals learning from this so it doesn't happen again. That's justice.
Yeah.
I mean, and this mom, you know, be the research tool that they can use to figure it out better next time she can be the reason why it doesn't happen again.
Justice is not pretending this wasn't a mental health crisis. And it's, if you're going with the prosecution, it's pretending this wasn't a mental health crisis. It's pretending she was just this evil, wretched woman who wanted to murder her three kids while her husband picked up Applebee's. Like, no, that doesn't seem like that. That seems like a narrative somebody wants to go on that doesn't think deeply at all. Justice is exactly, I agree 1,000%, Robin. It's looking at this for what it is and having a better understanding of this shit. So more moms don't have to go through it. So more fathers understand what they need to be looking for and how to handle and how to care for the woman that they love if they're in the situation that Patrick was. That seems more like justice than locking her away and throwing away the key.
Well, think about it. Regardless whether she's innocent by reason of insanity, she's spent her life behind bars in an asylum or whatever it is, or she's guilty and should be behind bars and she's still paralyzed from waist down, so there's nothing more you can really do to her, and you can't bring the kids back. So really the only thing that positive that can come from this, positive, I know it's a horrible word to use, but the only justice in this is learn so that we don't repeat our past bad behaviors that caused it in the first place.
Amen. All right. Yes. Now that we solved all the world's problems today, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in, and we'll continue these conversations right there. Those links are in the description. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching. Of course, we do this every single day, 11 a.m. Central on YouTube. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books and on audiobook. Go get it. Leave a review. Check it out. You'll love it. Until next time, for Robin and Todd and myself, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Moto Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Moto Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.